Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Hello, world. This is Pamela Elaine Lockridge for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, and we sponsor the Stop Child Abuse Now radio shows. And today, the scan number is 2653. The date is May 5th, 2021, and May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And so we have a very special guest that's coming on tonight, Lisa Zarcone. She is a NASCA ambassador from Massachusetts. She's been with NASCA for a very long time. She is a very special NASCA member. Of course, we're all special, but I'm just so excited for tonight to talk with her. Penelope is my trailer tonight. And she is the Washington ambassador, and I am the Alabama ambassador. We have we have Carol Levine. She's the vice president, and I'm very excited for tonight because we've got a robust panel, and we've also got a special guest. So, Penelope, would you go over the mission of NASCA and give our phone number out?
I would love to. Thank you so much, Pamela. And before I give the mission statement, I would like to give you the phone number to call in if you wish to be a member of our panel this evening. And the number to call in is 646-595-2118. Again, that number is 646-595-2118. And NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, is about child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA. It's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent and physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with two goals. The first, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse. Any facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that does affect everyone. The second goal, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, such as this show, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. So again, the number to call in is 646-595-2118. Thank you, Pamela.
Pamela,
there you go. Pamela, are you on? You might be on hold. You're on mute.
Yeah. Who's the 413 area code?
Okay, this is... It's Lisa.
Yeah, I think that's Lisa.
Hi,
so
Lisa.
Let me put...
Yeah, and then we have we have another guest from California. Okay, so I wanted to tell you that one of your fans has called in, but he let me know, Ed Squire.
Yes,
he's one of your biggest fans. He let me
I
know
love
that.
That. I love that. He's such a great guy. Oh, very sweet.
He is, isn't he? He's a rock star. Guess what he wants? To be Colorado ambassador. And I said, sure.
Yes, and he, you know, he works really hard at what he does.
He sure does. He sure does. So he's going to be amazing as an ambassador, don't you think?
I think he's going to be a fabulous ambassador.
Okay. Going down the panel, our vice president is here, Carol Levine. Also, we have Kim from Colorado, and we have Janice from California. So we've got a really robust panel that wants to interact with you, Lisa.
I think that's fantastic. I'm so glad to be here.
Yes, we're so happy to have you. I'm excited. I've been waiting all day. well, I just wanted to bring up May is Mental Health Awareness Month, right?
Yes, it is. And I'm glad to be on for Mental Health Awareness Month.
Can you tell us what you know about Mental Health Awareness Month? Do you have anything that you can share with us? Go ahead.
No, with Mental Health Awareness Month, of course, you know, I always say that every month there's, you know, everything is cued in for different months, you know, child abuse awareness. And I always say that, you know, for all these different things, we should always be aware 365 days a year. So when it comes to mental health and the stigmas that fall in place with it, we need to just continue to educate ourselves and others and always be aware of our surroundings and you know that people go through so many things that we just don't know about, and many people cover their illness because they've been shamed or, you know, they just feel like people won't understand. So I think the biggest thing about mental health and mental illness is just to offer kindness and compassion whenever you can, because, you know, the struggles are real and they're very difficult.
Right, and so much of Americans deal with mental illness.
Yes, and you know, it goes from childhood on up, and watching my own mother struggle, you know, with her mental health issues, it all started from her childhood, and it's generational. So that's another thing that people should be aware of and understand that, you know, you don't choose to be mentally ill, you don't choose to have a mental illness. You know, it's brought on by, you know, obviously it can be from trauma and abuse, but also it's generational, it's in the genes. And these are things that, you know, we have to deal with and learn about and, you know, take care of ourselves. People just need to remember not only being kind to others, but being kind to yourself because, you know, we've all been through things, and keeping ourselves mentally healthy and grounded is really important as well.
Right. I think it'd be good to mention that we really have come a long way when it comes to mental health. You know, back in the day, I don't know how long ago, 60s, 70s, people that were mentally ill were thought of as freaks, and we put them in institutions and wouldn't let them be part of society.
You know, and that's interesting, yeah, that you say that, because my childhood growing up and where all my trauma and abuse came from started in the 70s, and that it was that time of silence, and that was that time of my mother had mental illness and people, you know, shamed her for it and treated her poorly, and she never got the proper help and support that she needed. So yes, that generation, that era was really, really difficult time. And as we've moved forward now, yes, so much has been done and so many, you know, new programs have been implemented, but there's also still that stigma that we still need to break, because people still do frown upon others who struggle with mental illness.
Right. Okay, I want to ask you a question. You know, you've been on the show so many times and you're so involved with NASCA. I want you to start where you feel comfortable with your story, okay? You know how the show goes. We have different segments. And, of course, we're already 10 minutes into the show. But go ahead and tell what you want to, and when you're ready to go to the panel, let us know.
Okay. Well, first of all, I just want to say, you know, again, thank you for having me tonight. You know, it's always home when I come here to speak or talk or be on the panel when someone else is, you know, sharing. I always love coming here. And I love my title and all that it represents, and I truly take it to heart, and I use it every single day out there in the world to advocate for children and for, you know, mental illness and all, you know, all the things that are out there that we work, you know, we work with and educate on. But where I want to start is I just want to say that I have been on the show before. I've shared my story before, but every single time I share my story, I hold my book. So right now in my hand, I am holding my own personal story, The Unspoken Truth, which is my story and my life. And I hold it with pride, and I hold it with care, and I hold it with empowerment, because when I was able to break the silence of my story and then to put it onto paper and then to publish it, it's just such an empowering moment, and it really pushed me forward on my healing journey, which I do want to talk about later on. But as I hold my book and I think about that child, that small six-year-old child, alone and sad because she just lost her brother. Her brother, her best friend, her protector. He protected me from so many things, my brother John. And at the age of 9, he died of leukemia. And when that happened, my world definitely fell apart in so many ways. My parents fell apart. I fell apart. And life just took a turn to a dark place where I never could have ever imagined it would have gone. So after the death of my brother, my dad threw himself into his work, into life outside of the home. He was barely around, and when he was around, it was a very volatile situation between my parents. I witnessed many arguments, many verbal arguments, things being thrown, a lot of dysfunction. Interesting enough, through all of that, my dad never once put his hands on my mother, and any time that they fought, he was so enraged with the things she would say and do, and he would break everything around her, but he would never touch her. But the trauma that I went through alone, just with that piece, just with the domestic violence and the verbal abuse, was terrifying. And as a little girl, being left home alone with my mom, who was so sick with her mental illness, I mean, she lost her son. She was losing her marriage. She was already battling mental illness before any of this even transpired. It was a very scary place to be, especially when you're a six-year-old little girl who just doesn't understand anything. And I lived my life in the unknown. I lived my life, you know, stepping forward, never knowing what was going to happen next. But as time went on, my mother got worse. And that's when the abuse turned on to me, the physical aspect, the mental aspect, the emotional abuse. My mother would say and do many scary things. And I know I've talked about this before, but for someone who may not have heard my story before, there were moments in my mom's mania and depression that she would do the highs and the lows. So one minute she would be sitting on the couch crying, talking to herself, swearing, smoking her cigarettes, and like lethargic, couldn't move, to the next moment so manic that she would be dancing and screaming and raging and just like on such a, I call it a psychotic high. I guess that's really the best way to put it, as awful as that sounds. But when I envision her in my mind, and I can see her right now as I'm talking about it, she would be screaming and dancing. And she would urinate all over herself, and she would urinate on the floor, and she would dance in her own urine like she was like in freedom in that moment. But imagine being the child sitting there watching it, living it every day. It was very scary and just very unsettling. And I had no one to talk to. I had no adults that would... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Did she have any siblings? Anybody that could intervene with her?
So this is what I was just going to say that. So there were no adults that came in to, you know, help us in regards to taking me out of the situation or really helping my mom, you know, get the proper help that she needed. And you know, she had siblings. She had a sister and two brothers, and she had, you know, a whole family. We had a whole family around us. And, you know, my dad would leave for work, and me and my mom would be there alone, you know, and if I wasn't off into school, then I was back home. There was always trauma going on. There was always dysfunction happening. So my mom would go from those extremes, but then she would also go into violence. And that came on probably when I was about 8 or 9, when the violent things would come into play. My mother would get this really strange glazed look over her face with these dark eyes, and it's like she was totally gone. And I was always examining her because I was trying to figure her out and figure out which mom I'm going to get, which Joanne is there at that moment. And when she get that dark look on her face, I always knew that was my cue that something really bad was probably going to happen. And 9 times out of 10, something bad would happen. And, you know, she would either, you know, come at me with something, which could be either a knife or a scissors. She would throw things at me. She would throw silverware at me. She'd throw knives at me all the time, and I would be dodging and weaving to get away from them, you know. And she would hit me with items. And, you know, and then afterwards she would say things like, you know I love you. You know how much mommy loves you. And it was just a twisted routine that we would go through day in and day out. So when I talk about, you know, my family life and my life growing up, it wasn't just this happened for a very short period of time and then it changed. This went on for years. So from the age of 6 years old, and now I'm into, say, 10, 11 years old, these things were still happening. And I would go to school and I would pretend like nothing was wrong. I think it was more about I was so traumatized by what was happening to me. I couldn't get the words out. I couldn't say it. I didn't even know where to go. But I would look at people with these eyes, and I would like my eyes would pierce right through people because I was hoping and praying that somebody would just see what was happening to me. And no one ever stepped in, and no one intervened. You know, I was always known as the kid in school who had the crazy mother. I was the kid in school who had the brother that died. You know, those types of things I was labeled at a young age.
So,
and they followed me all the way through.
Did you ever ask yourself why any other adult didn't intervene? Not for your safety, but for her health. I mean, she was obviously, you know, in need of help. Mental health.
Yes. Yeah. And even as a young kid, I was a very inquisitive kid, and I was very aware, and I had to be because I always had to, you know, I would say put one eye open, you know, because I was always in fear. But I was very inquisitive. I was very smart. And I would think to myself all the time, why isn't anyone helping, you know, and where's my father and where's my family? And I would think about those things. So my mom had in-home therapy, so the therapist would come to the house. So there would be, this is another thing, when you think of sign of the times and you think of another way a kid could be traumatized, let them sit in on a group therapy session with probably 5 or 6 people who are all mentally ill like my mother, sharing their stories, smoking, screaming, swearing, crying, and you're the little kid sitting in the corner listening to it, and then watching the therapist pass out pills to everybody.
Oh, my God.
That's the sign of the 70s. That is, there was, because my mom didn't want to go to the office, so they did in-home therapy, and I had to witness that. So, interesting, the only person who tried to intervene was my mother's therapist, because she was very well aware that I was being traumatized. And she was very well aware it wasn't just with the group therapy happening. It was what's happening in my home all the time. And she questioned my dad about getting me help because she felt that I had trauma. And my father point blank said to her, and I remember I was standing right there because I had a moment of hope where I thought maybe somebody was going to help me or save me. And my dad point blank said to her, you are here to help my wife. My daughter's off limits. If you say anything to me again about it or to anyone else, you will never be allowed back in this house.
Oh, my God. That should have triggered, you know, set off red flags right there.
Well, yes, and she never did anything else about it. She continued to take care of my mom for a little bit longer, and then she was gone. And uh-huh. that was that, and life went on, and life got scarier. It got darker because my mom became more intense with her illness. More, she'd take herself off her medications, and I mean, one night she came into my room with scissors in her hand. And she's standing over my bed with these scissors. And I'm, like, crying. I'm like, Mom, what are you doing? And once again, she had that serious glazed look over her eyes where she, like, her eyes looked black. There was no feeling, no emotion. And, you know, she's standing there with these scissors. And I'm thinking, what's going to happen now? Is she going to stab me? I don't know what's happening. And then just like that, she would walk back out, which was even more scary because she never said a word. I didn't know if she was coming back, and I would just lay in my bed and I would cry. And then the next morning you get up and you start your day all over again, and it's off to school, it's off living your life. You walk out that door, you put on your game face, you never say a word. And that was the routine of my life for a very long time. The abuse was daily. The abuse could be 2 o'clock in the morning, it could be 3 o'clock in the afternoon when I get home. It was always, something was always happening. I can go on and on with stories about all these things. And, you know, my mom would bring strangers into the home, and that was a whole other thing, being preyed upon by you know, strangers. Well, and so there was many aspects to what was happening with me, and this was all before the sexual abuse came into play. So I don't know if you want me to stop here.
I think it would be a good idea to take a breath. And I know you've gone to a dark place, but I also know you've recovered from everything. So, but whenever we tell our story, I don't care how recovered we are, we still feel those body senses. You know.
You feel that.
Yeah. It's visceral. You know, we can't help it. But telling our story, each time we do, we're more empowered, though. So it's like a bittersweet, right?
Yes.
But
this is true.
So I wanted to make a comment. I'm a social worker, so looking through the social worker eyes, if your dad had talked to me as a therapist, as a social worker, I would have called CPS. But I don't know if what they did back then for CPS, you know, Child Protective Services. I mean, that therapist should have been mandated to protect you, but I don't know
But I think back at that time, I don't think those things were set into place. You very rarely heard about Child Protective Services. Everything was very hush-hush, and everything was under the carpet all the time, and it always goes back to this word that drives me insane, which is called protocol. There's always a protocol. Even my family said to me, protocol. Your father was the one who should have taken care of you. That's why no one stepped in. It's about protocol. That word drives me crazy.
I would say that's the protocol right here, buddy.
Exactly. And
that's the protocol.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, I go back to those signs of the times. And you know, even today you hear these stories of children that have been in foster care or were placed back into the homes. And you think to yourself, what was that social worker thinking about putting a child into a dirty, filthy environment after you already taken them out? Why would you ever want to place them back? So, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done. But back in the day, it was nil.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to bring Penelope on to interact with you. Would that be okay, Lisa?
Okay, that's great.
Penelope, do you have a comment or a question? We got a lot. We got a lot on the panel. We've got about six people on the panel.
And yes, I do, and I will get to 484 right after this. So thank you, Pamela, for giving me the opportunity. And hello, Lisa. I'm sending you a hug through the phone.
Oh, hi. I'm hugging you right back.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh my gosh, I wrote down a few things, and I won't take up very much time because we have a lot of people supporting you and calling in this evening. Man, I just wrote down, she was living in landmines. We were living in landmines. So that was my comment. My question is.
Oh, I was going to say, your comment is on point. It was living in landmines.
Yeah, I think it's on point because I can relate to that. So here you are 6 years old through, 11, 12, and you described your mother's conduct and your father's conduct. And I'm sitting here thinking, okay, you were at home alone with your mom for the most part. Who was the parent? Were you having to mother your mother? You were a little six-year-old girl, and your mother's mentally ill.
That's interesting. Interesting question. I did mother my mother. I mothered my mother probably from that time period on up until the end of my mother's lifetime. As a child, I did. I just wanted my mother to be okay. I just wanted my mom to be a mom. I just wanted a mom that was going to take care of me and not hurt me and not scare me. But at the same time, I felt this very strong commitment to mothering her. I did.
And that is, for a child living in fear, living on landmines, completely on bankrupt. Children are supposed to be children, right? We're supposed to be nurtured. Those are our developmental years. So here you are on bankrupt. You're already bankrupt. You're already depleted. And for a child that then have to take what they don't have to give, what they should never have to do at such a young age, and become that parent is a very deep wound. And you're just, I don't want to jump ahead, but we know who you are now. The fact that you are who you are today, that is such a deep wound, and that resonates with me. And I just wanted to acknowledge that. And thank you for answering my question.
Oh, thank you, and thank you, for your kindness and your support. I understand what you're saying, and yes, it was a dark time, but there's always light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what Pamela alluded to when you come on the show and you tell your story. It's this crossroads. It's this intersection of just you go to the places that were so painful, but there is such peace, that comes in telling our story. So thank you for all that you're giving us tonight.
Oh,
and
thank you,
Pam, for the opportunity to interact with Lisa. Pamela, I think you might be on mute again.
She might be on mute, but Penelope, thank you. I truly appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to go to our Vice President of NASCA, Carol Levine. You're on with Ms. Lisa Zarcone, our ambassador from Massachusetts.
Lisa, I'm so happy you're here.
Carol, I'm so happy to be here.
No, I know, honey, I know. And I adore you, you adore me. We have this mutual respect. There's certain things that were said earlier, and it's true. Back in the 70s, there wasn't really much for mental health at all. Okay, and CPS workers, they didn't get involved, and in fact, there was hardly any CPS workers. There were some, because I had them in New York at my house, but there wasn't nearly as much as there is today. Are they good? Some are good, and some are bad. Okay,
true.
And you're speaking to someone that worked in a psychiatric, facility, hospital, state certified. And quite frankly, I did that in the 90s. So we're jumping now from the 70s to the 90s, all right? And all they do was Thorazine them out. And most of them didn't have family that cared, because a lot of times the people who were involved, the patients themselves were so mentally ill that the family could not and would not, work with them, didn't want them in the home. When you're speaking about with the children, it's a horrifying thing for children to watch, people who are mentally ill. I have mentally ill people who are extended family members, and you're right, it is generational. Of course, it skipped over me, didn't it?
It did, absolutely.
it absolutely did, just ask me, by God. But anyway, it's a terrifying thing, because I can pick out those who are really mentally ill, because I learned so much in the field. And it's a very terrifying thing for a child to watch that. And yes, we do take on the mothering or the father role, you know what I'm saying, either parent. because we want our parents to be better. And that's another way of losing our childhood.
Yes, definitely, definitely, because I did always, I was always concerned about my mom, worried, and, you know, mm-hmm. wanted to make her better. And I would get angry with myself for not being able to make my mother better. And I couldn't have been more than 7 years old when I felt that way.
I know. Horrifying.
Wow.
But I am so happy, honey, that you're here tonight, because mental illness doesn't really get the attention that it needs. And a lot of people don't have the understanding either of mental illness and just how horrifying, horrific it can be for the whole family, and especially for a little six-year-old. I was the same age as you. I was actually a little bit younger when I was watching all kinds of, you know, knives flying through the air.
Yes.
And all,
yes.
And all kinds of things. Mine started at four. And I remember one of the kids down the street said to me, "Carol, why is your father like that? And why is your mother like that?" And I turned and I looked at him and I said, "I don't know. I'm just a kid."
Exactly, and it's the truth. And I, you know, in reading your story, I related to many of those things than what you talked about in your childhood, because that violence is just so profound. Those things, you know, no matter how much we heal and move forward, those things always stay with you. Those images, you do hold on to that.
Yes, and I still remember today like it was yesterday, if I allow myself.
Yes,
you know,
I understand
if you look
that.
Back, yeah, mm-hmm. And I tend not to want to do that. So thank you again, you know, for being on the show. This is great.
Thank you. I'm just glad to hear your voice.
Yeah, you bet. Okay, honey. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go to Kim in Colorado. Kim is a brand new NASCA member, and she did tell her story recently, Lisa. Kim from Colorado, and she wants to make a comment or a question.
I've been kind of in and out a little bit of NASCA the last few years, I think. So I'm kind of new, but I'm sending you hugs too, Lisa. I just
thank you.
It breaks my heart every time I hear another story of child abuse, and it just always gets to me. And I know that, like you're talking about, our mothers are always complicated relationships. It seems like in every family,
yes.
They've got some kind of complications. But then you have, you know, that on top of it. And I didn't have mental health issues. I just had them doing drugs. But they were, you know, my mom was in the court systems. And so she was around, you know.
Very.
Yes.
And, I'm sure you've witnessed all those things. And, you know, you talk about, you know, mental illness, but when you have drug addictions as well and people they surround themselves with, it's a scary place to be.
It is. I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. And I took care of my mom too. My mom was 16 when she had me. So
she was a baby.
We grew up together.
Yeah,
yeah. And I was a baby too. And I took care of my younger brother. And that broke my heart too. I'm so sorry about your brother. I do.
I had
a younger brother, and he just passed away 4 years ago, and it's been really hard.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear about that. I'm sure it was
very hard.
No. You know, we all
it's
have
always
this,
hard.
We do. You know, the interesting thing about us talking about our stories and sharing them is that we are all connected. You know, our stories are all personal and different and unique, but we're all connected by these circumstances, and we feel for one another. So when you send me that hug, I'm sending it right back to you because I know that pain.
Aww. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. Is your mom still alive?
No,
or are
my
you
mom.
Are going to get to that?
Yeah, I will get to that. But yeah, that happened later on, though. My mom passed away 7 years ago.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry about that, too, because that's a whole other complicated thing, I know.
That could be a whole other show.
Yeah, that's a whole other complicated thing.
That could be a whole other animal right
there. Years.
Thank you,
Pam. Yeah, just sending you hugs. Thank you.
Thank you.
For letting me on.
Pamela, I just want to say sorry for thinking you were new. I'm fairly new.
No, that's fine.
Okay. I
just haven't been around.
Okay. Well, we're going to make sure you stick around.
You keep sending me stuff, say get on, and I probably will. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we're going to go down to Janice. She's in California. You're on with Lisa, Janice. Janice?
Yes, I'm here. Well, your story is heartbreaking, and I'm sorry about your childhood. I really want to hear more of your story, but you sound good. So it sounds
Thank you, Janice. I appreciate you
and
saying that.
Says something, yeah.
Yeah.
So
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, so I want to hear more of your story, but I can tell by the sound of your voice that you're doing well.
You know, yes, I am, and I'm grateful for my healing journey, and I do want to touch upon that at the end a little bit because the healing part is so important to get to the place where I am right now, and every time I share my story, it just puts me at a just feeling a little bit better each and every time.
Well, continue on your journey. That's great.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you, Janice. We'll get back to you. All right. I want to introduce Adrienne. She is our brand new Pennsylvania ambassador. Adrienne, this is Lisa from she's the Massachusetts ambassador. So I want y'all to get acquainted. And if you have a comment or support comment or question for Lisa, go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Adrienne. Congratulations.
Hi.
Welcome aboard the family.
Oh, thank you. I'm enjoying helping out and just encouraging others. I'm looking through, I'm sorry to hear about your story. It took a lot of courage for you to come on. I'm looking at the Unspoken Truth, your book that came out in 2016.
Yes.
And you're going to get a copy of it. But this chapter three, did that talk about the loss of your childhood or chapter three? Because I just wanted to get an overlook of what's going on because I'm really interested in your book here.
Yeah, chapter three. I'm holding my book right as we speak. Chapter three, yes, talks about loss after my brother. And if I think back into chapter three, it's really talking about trying to live my life with the trauma and trying to live without my brother being there protecting me because he was my great protector. He sheltered me a lot from my mom's illness before he died, and he tried to protect me the best he could because my mom was sick from the age of when I was like two on up, and you know he was really good about nurturing and talk about taking the parental role. He took the parental role with me, and he was just a little boy, but he was very protective and very nurturing, and losing him was quite devastating. And I think if I'm remembering correctly, in chapter three, I talk about a moment where I'm looking up at the sky, and all of a sudden the clouds opened up, and I saw my brother's face, and I started screaming at the sky, and I'm like, John, don't leave me, don't go. And I can see it, as I'm telling you, I can see the moment, and all of a sudden his face disappeared, and I'm on the front lawn, and I completely lost it like there was no tomorrow. My mother came out, and she was trying to console me, and there was no consoling me. I think it was just, you know, that moment that I realized he wasn't coming back. And my mother carried me down to my neighbors because she didn't know what to do with me. And I'm kicking and screaming. And I was just so, so out of my mind. And when it was all over and she took me home and I went into the house and she never said another word to me about it. That was the thing about my family. They never talked about anything. Everything was silent. So I went through this trauma just alone of that, and there was never even talked about afterwards. So the transition after my brother was very difficult.
Yeah. Well, it says here, I had to pull deep within my soul to muster up the strength and the courage to survive. So it's really awesome that you're out here giving courage to others. And
Thank you.
I just want to know, is your book on our NASCA book list? Can I put it on there?
I believe it's on the NASCA. I believe it's on the NASCA book list, and you know, if you do Kindle, it's on Kindle. It's on Amazon. It's, you know, you can always go to my website, lisazarcone.net, and it'll bring you to the links of where it is. But I appreciate you wanting to read my story, and I'll tell you right now, it's a very raw story. I write it from the child's perspective, and I am graphic at times. I always say trigger warning because when it comes into the sexual abuse part, I am very raw and graphic. I wanted people to understand the reality of abuse.
Yes. Well, thank you, Lisa. I look forward to talking to you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Reach out anytime.
I will.
Thank you.
you're doing a great job, and you're where we really understand. Wherever you want to pick up, fine. We're at the hour point, so 50 minutes left. So
yeah,
but I was gonna ask you one question though. Can we leave some time for you to talk about our ambassadorship at NASCA? Because we're really trying to get this program up and running. So I don't know when you want to.
We can leave at the last few minutes. Let's drop into that. And I will cut through my story a little bit quicker. I do want to share a couple of things that I'm working on for future stuff as well with mental health. But go back into my story in regards to talking about my childhood with my mom, that abuse. I want to switch gears slightly because I think I was mentioning that my mother brought different people into the household that would prey upon me. And that's where the second stage of abuse came in from another abuser. And that's this scenario. It's when I still think back to it, it's still mind-blowing to me to think that this really happened to me. But there was a young man in our neighborhood who was in our neighborhood and then left because he was kicked out. He actually, as a child, pulled a knife out of my brother and was kicked out of the neighborhood and then moved away and then came back. And one day my mom was on the porch and he showed up and he wormed his way back into our household after so many years of being gone. And at this time I was like just about 13. And he told my mother he was sick like my brother. He needed help. He needed support. And my mother wholeheartedly wanted to take care of him because that's what she would do. She would, you know, just bring all types of people in. And he, from day one, you know, began to prey upon me. And he said to me that you are going to now be my girlfriend. And I'm like, oh, I'm not going to be your girlfriend. I hate you and what you did to my brother. And the last thing I want to do is be affiliated with you. And, you know, and he would come every single day. And he would start in by verbally abusing me and wearing me down. I was already a damaged young girl. My mind was already so clouded after being damaged by what was happening in my home. And he would tell me, you know, all the things that the grooming process and the gaslighting and all those words that we hear today, he was classic at every single one of them. And he started with the verbal abuse, the breaking me down, and then started with the physical abuse to take over. And he would do this many times with my mother right in the next room. He would drag me into the other room. My mother would never, you know, even question what was happening. And he would, you know, physically assault me and hurt me and threaten me. And he was very torturistic with the abuse because he would repeat satanic verses and things. And, you know, when we took his moment to take me completely and rape me, he did. And I was 13 years old, and, you know, he raped me while my mother was in the next room, and I could hear my mother's music blaring. I could hear my mother singing and screaming, and I'm in the next room being raped, and he's preaching satanic things to me. And when it was all over, he just looked at me and said, "Now you're mine." And it was like game over. And I was stuck, when I say stuck, completely stuck in this abusive relationship for almost 2 years before I could finally break free from his clutches. And the things that he would do were so horrific and so torturistic, and I won't even go into the details. I do detail it in my book, and again, when I say if anyone reads my book or has read my book, they know it's very graphic. And He really wreaked havoc and hell in my life, and it took every ounce of my strength to get away from him. At one point, I wanted to die, and I planned, you know, to commit suicide, and I was going to, and I didn't follow through with it that day because a voice inside of me, deep inside of me, said to me, "No, don't do it, Lisa. Don't do it." And I believe that voice was my brother. I always believed that my brother was my guardian angel. And because of that voice that I heard, I did not follow through on my plan on that day. But I did go home, and I did decide that it was time to fight for myself. And I truly came to that point after the last time I was abused so horrifically that he left me bleeding and horrendously beaten up. And I decided that it was time. It was time to fight for me. And I did. And here I am. I wasn't even 14 at the time. And I fought tooth and nail to get away from him. And when I finally did, as awful as this sounds, it came at the expense of my mom. My mom tried to commit suicide herself, and she was missing. And I called my family members, and I said, you have to come get me. I have nowhere to go. My mom's not here. And they did come get me and brought me to my grandparents. And that saved me. That was my first big break away from my abuser, because when I was around my family, he couldn't get to me. And he stalked me for a very long time. And whenever he did get a hold of me, you would be sure every single time that I would be beaten or raped until I could finally get that final break from him. And it took a very long time. And during this process, I'm in school and I'm trying to learn. And, you know, I am just all over the place. I'm a hot mess and trying to figure it out. And I'm still living in silence. I lived in silence. I lived with this for so many years, and in my mind, the only way to save myself was to bury it, and that's what I did. I buried it, and I decided I was just going to try to make a good life for myself, and I pushed forward, and I got good grades in school. I knew I was going to graduate and do good things with my life, and in my mind, I just kept telling myself, don't bring it up. Don't show it. And at that point, it was so painful, I couldn't even say the words out loud, but there was the rumors, there was the whispers, you know, of all these different things, and I had to live with that too. And then I had to lie, and I was never a liar, but I lied. I was like, people would say to me, I heard this happen. I'm like, no. I heard you were pregnant and had an abortion. I said, no. And I kept pushing forward, but the truth of the matter was that I did get pregnant. The final time that I was raped, I became pregnant, and I was just 14, and I had to have an abortion, and I had to live with that as well. And, you know, even though I knew it was the right thing and I didn't want a child, I still live with that guilt of, you know, ending a life. But that wasn't...
Absolutely.
That was not something
yeah.
I wanted or, you know, and in the midst of all that craziness and chaos that was happening, my mother wanted me to have this baby because in her mind, she's like, I'm going to give her a child that she lost. So talk about messing
right.
with your brain just a little bit more. So it was a very difficult time, and pushing forward to make a real life for myself was a very, very, very difficult journey.
Who helped you get the abortion?
I'm sorry?
Who knew about it? Who helped you get the abortion? Who knew about it?
Well,
that you were pregnant.
Well, I went to the doctors. I was sick. Well, what happened was, to be honest, the way they found out that I was pregnant, I literally was getting breakfast in the morning, and I passed out cold. And they brought me to the doctors, and the doctor automatically did blood work and did a pregnancy test, never even said anything about if I could be pregnant or anything, never even asked me. Then calls my father, doesn't even, like, you know, here I am. As a kid, I have no idea what's happening at this point. And then doctor never even questioned me about pregnancy or how I got pregnant or whatever, if something bad happened to me. He just called my father and just said, your daughter's pregnant. And, you know, my
wow.
father went through the roof, and I couldn't even explain to my father what was happening to me. And I knew people knew there was bruises on me. People saw bruises, knew that my abuser was in my life. And no one ever asked the questions. No one ever said, were you being abused? Are you okay? Nope, they found out I was pregnant. Everyone flipped out. My dad was like, you can't have this baby. I'm like, well, I don't want this baby. And my mother created a big old fight about the fact that she wanted this baby. And the end of the story to all that was my father took me to have an abortion. And then he dropped me off at my grandmother's house and didn't talk to me for probably 2 weeks. Didn't even, you know, want to see me or even ask, you know, was I okay? Or, you know, none of my family even asked me anything. That's how it was. We just moved forward. Everything
yeah.
was about moving forward.
You're telling the story of so many, and they're not alone in that their family could care less about them. You know, as long as it's
yes.
a bunch of narcissists, you know. It's all about me.
I think back, you know, and I always think back then to the fact that everything was private. Nobody talked about it. No one asked questions. Going back to that awful term protocol, which I, like I said, I hate that word because, you know, I, as an adult looking back and asking family members, why didn't you step in? And it always, and my family members said that to me. It was protocol that your father should have taken care of you better and taken care of your mother. And I said, well, my dad was obviously sick in his own right after he lost his wife and his child and all these things happened. Yeah, did he do the right thing by me? No. But he was sick. So who steps in when the parents can't do it? And, you know, they looked at me and it's like, well, it was the protocol. That's what it was like back then. And that was the end of that conversation.
Did your abuser ever get any sent? Did you bring him to court? I mean, did he ever get criminally charged?
No, I could tell you this from what I know a few things about my abuser now, even as an adult. But at that time, finally I was able to get away from him. I never spoke of what happened to me. Little tidbits came out here and there, but nothing to the extreme of the truth of what really happened. And he moved forward. He found another young girl, a girl I actually went to high school with, and he beat her tremendously. She would come to school with black eyes. I actually even had a confrontation with her on more than one occasion because I even said to her one time, you need to get away. You need to get away. It's not going to end well. And she ended up pregnant, and they moved away to Florida, and that was the end of that. He was gone.
Well, thank God that you didn't succumb to him, you know.
I'm grateful that I had the strength and the courage to get away. And once again, with every ounce of my being and everything inside of me that I fought tooth and nail just to survive, just to make it through with the hope that things would get better. And that's one thing I could tell you, even as a young kid and all the way through all of this horrendousness that happened to me, I had a lot of hope and I had a lot of faith. And I would always pray to my brother and to my angels, as I would call them, and I would just pray that things would get better. And I was always hopeful. And I would try to find things to make myself happy. Like I would go into the woods with my dog, and I'd sit under the pine trees, and I would, you know, bring out my sketch pad and my writing tools, and I would write poems, and I would draw, and I would find peaceful moments. And even to this day, nature is what calms me the most. It's a coping skill. I got that coping skill as a young child, and I always would go out into nature. And to this day, nature still brings me, it grounds me when I'm feeling unsettled.
Awesome. Well, where are we headed in the story right now? We have 30 minutes left, believe it or not.
Yes, we can move forward. We can move forward from here if you want to, because people may have questions. I mean, that time in my life was very turbulent because I was also at that same time of dealing with sexual abuse. I was still dealing with the abuse of my mother. So everything prior that I shared about the abuse my mother was giving me was still happening on top of the sexual abuse. And my mother's violence raged on for years as a child into teenage years.
Okay. Did you go to college after your teenage years?
I did. I ended up, you know, I was very proud of myself. I had goals, and I set goals for myself, and I graduated with honors, and I went to a secretarial college. I wanted to be able to get an education. I wanted to get a career. I wanted to get out of my house as quick as humanly possible. We had gone from my house where I lived growing up to my grandparents, and we lived there until I was able to move out on my own. But my grandparents' home, I love my grandparents dearly, and, you know, God bless them. But there was another difficult household. Their household also had much dysfunction. My grandfather was an alcoholic, and my grandmother was blind. There was a lot of stresses there. And then add in my mother and my uncle, who was into drugs at that time. There was a lot happening in this house. I'm surprised the roof did not literally blow off because of the energy in that home. So I lived a really crazy, a really crazy lifestyle for many years until I was able to get out and move out on my own and as a grown woman get married and have my own family. But with that silence that stayed with me, it came back to haunt me and it kicked me in the ass in the biggest way possible. And that happened after I was married 10 years and three children later. Everything from my past came forward, and everything I repressed for so many years came forward and really did a lot of damage before it got better.
Did you have to go into therapy, like with a trauma-based therapist, or how did you cope at that point?
I went to therapy. I started therapy, and I went throughout my whole healing process. I went to therapy three separate times and worked through these things one by one. And, you know, it's interesting because I had to take it all in stages because it was so dark and so heavy that I had to break it into small pieces to actually deal with it, acknowledge it, say it out loud. It really was a hard, hard time for me because not only was I on my own healing journey, I was a young mom of three small children. I was a wife. I was trying to be a good wife, a good mother. I was still dealing with my mom and all her mental health issues. I was her advocate. I was, you know, I always said I ran in between two worlds all the time because that's how I always felt. I was in the past and present all at the same time, and I was trying to keep it all under wraps and prioritize. It was very difficult. It was very, very hard and sometimes very painstaking to even get through a day and trying to be successful in all aspects of life and still try to heal. And it took me a long time. And, you know, my last therapist is the one who helped me put together my book because as I came in and shared with him these things that happened to me, you know, he said, write them down and bring them in. And as one by one, the story came together. So the biggest advice I tell people all the time when you're on your healing journey, start at the beginning. Take it in small doses. Break it down piece by piece. And as you get through each piece, you make your own personal peace with that and let it go. And then you go on to the next. Because when you break it down into those small pieces, you take it as you can. And before you know it, you are on your healing journey. And once you get to the other side and you're looking back, it's just an amazing feeling to know that no matter what you've been through in life, you're still standing and you're recreating and you're becoming whole once again in a whole new way. You're always going to be damaged from the past, but that doesn't mean that your life and your future has to be dark. You do the opposite. And that's when I feel you win the game. You do not let your abusers win because you are living, you're thriving, and you're surviving. And, you know, purpose for pain,
yeah.
Writing my book, telling my story, doing my advocacy work, all that is just parts of giving back and putting a purpose to all the pain that I went through.
Do you believe in the statement that some people say that forgiveness is for the other person, and did you have to deal with that at all? Or you didn't deal with forgiveness at all.
Forgiveness.
I mean,
you know, forgiveness is such a big word. You say that in people's eyes, like, rather they pop out of their head. Forgiveness. What do you mean, forgiveness? You know. But for me, when I think of forgiveness and when I look at my own forgiveness, because forgiveness is so personal, and not everyone gets to that place of forgiveness. And you can't look at anybody and say, well, you have to forgive. No, they don't have to forgive. It's your
right.
choice. You have that control, and that's the control you deserve because you've been through hell, and you have the right to say whether you want to or not. I personally
yeah.
found forgiveness this way. I look through the eyes of my abusers. I look through the eyes of my parents and their struggles, and through that, I found rhyme and reason to why things happened to me. I put a purpose a reasoning for what happened. Does it make it right or does it make it better because I have a reason? No, it's nothing. None of that should have ever happened to me. But I put myself in my parents' shoes and what they were feeling, and I found perspective there. I was even able to put myself in my sexual abuser's shoes because in his backstory, he was an abused child. He was mentally ill. He was damaged. What he did to me was so horrific and horrendous, I cannot tell you that I've forgiven him totally. What I do forgive and what I feel sorry for or sad for is the fact that he was an abused child. And nobody deserves that. So I found forgiveness from my parents through love because I loved my parents regardless of what happened. I found their understanding of why things happened because their life was hard for both of them. It saddens me to think that I was lost in the shuffle. But I also knew at the end of the day, regardless of all of it, I knew my parents always had great love for me. And I think that's where I found my forgiveness.
I call that unconditional love. There's no conditions on it. You're not saying, well, if you'd have done this, I'll love you. But since you did this, I don't love you. Love is so, it's so, such a supernatural thing when you think about it. You know, how do you love people? You love people just because they're this way? Well, that's not real love, you know? I love you if you don't say something wrong to me. I mean, we all make mistakes. We're fallible, you know, we're full of flaws and faults, and
yes,
you
and
know,
I
can't say that I've never, yeah.
No, I was going to say, is even like, you know, looking at my parents, even, you know, from a young age to a teenage years when I went through the whole angry, I was so angry as a teenager. It was just, oh, I was horrendously angry at everything, and I had every right to be, but I always knew deep down inside my heart that my parents, even though they couldn't and didn't do the right things by me, I knew that there was love there, and I knew that it was almost all beyond all of our control at some points because it was just so, I was just out of control and craziness, and there was just so much happening, and everything fell apart. And, you know, I can say this, is that I made peace with my dad. Him and I made peace together, and as a grown woman, him and I had a phenomenal relationship. We were able to overcome his shortcomings and why things happened. And, you know, my dad died young. He was 69, and I was devastated when he died because him and I did establish such a strong bond. And for my mom, my heart broke for my mom because I have to tell you, like, you know, she suffered tremendously. Even though I went through hell, she did too. And,
yeah,
you know, I was my mom's greatest advocate right up until the last breath. My mom, I fought for her. I fought for her, you know, her good, you know, being cared for. I fought for where she was and how people were caring for her and, you know, all of that. And I stuck by her side. And, you know, every once in a while I would visit her and we would have this incredible visit. And she would be so on point and so clear in her mind. And she would share all these things with me, and we would talk. And in those moments, I felt like those were little gifts that I was being given for everything that was taken away from me. And every time I saw her, I was always hopeful that I'd have another one of those visits. And they were far and few between because usually she was ranting, raving, and, you know, having her moment. And but when we would have these moments of clarity, and it was just me and her, that's when I saw Joanne. That's when I saw my mom. And I was like, wow, she's really an intelligent, incredibly beautiful woman. And it's so sad that this illness ate her alive. And, you know, moving forward here, book two is almost done. I've told you about Book of Joanne, and it's my mom's story. And it talks about the generational effects of mental illness and abuse and how the abuse came, you know, was back in my mom's time frame when she was abused as a child and all the way on up to, you know, our relationship and mother and daughter and everything that we had gone through. So the Book of Joanne is a tribute to her story and her life. And it's another way I can advocate for mental health because it's going to talk, it talks a great deal about the mental health journey of my mother.
Oh, that is going to be amazing. When is it coming out?
I've just finished chapter 20. I've got a couple of chapters left to wrap up, and then it's going to, my goal is before the end of 2020 that this book is going to be in people's hands and we can talk more about how we can help people overcome their struggles and the reality of mental illness and what we need to do to help and not stigmatize.
That is so perfect. Oh, that's going to be an amazing book.
I'm very excited about it.
So
just one quick question, and then we're going to go down the panel. How has that, has it been hard or and piece by piece, or has it just flowed? Or you know how books, sometimes they just flow, and like I started mine and have done in a year, but my story got closure, so I was able to do that. How's this book, how long have you been working on it, and how has it come to you?
Well, the Book of Joanne has been in the process for a good 2 years, a little more than that. The pandemic really put a squash on it because with the kids home, homeschooled them for a whole year because of, you know, COVID, and I just couldn't write the way I needed to, so I kind of put it on the back burner and touched upon it here and there. And as the first of the year came around, I said, I've got to get this done. This is my goal. I need to complete what I started, and I've been pushing to try to get through it. So now the kids are back into school, so my goal now is to throw myself into finishing these last couple of chapters and wrapping it up. It's been a journey putting myself in my mother's shoes, and I have to say, sometimes writing from her thoughts, It even gives me a deeper understanding of how sick she really was and how much she really struggled. And it gave me a new, I guess if you want to say a new respect for her trying so hard, because she always showed, her voice and her words were always, I choose life. No matter how awful it was for her and how sad and how low she was, she always said, I choose life. And right down to her last breath, this is one of the last things she said to me, is I'm going to choose life until I can't choose it anymore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, wow. She had a strong spirit. She really, really did. And so, yeah, this book, you know, coming together, it's really going to be another powerful look at family dynamics, like I said, generational, you know, mental illness and abuse and how it all comes together.
Yeah.
But it also talks about love, you know, and connections.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I think about when I think about people coming against people with mental illness and thinking of it different is, would you beat somebody up who has cancer and say, you're a cancer patient? You know, I mean, it's the
yes.
same thing, you know, beat somebody up with words, you know, you got a mental illness. It's just like doing that, you know, and it's ridiculous.
It's true. And that's still that fine line that we ride with the stigmas of mental illness. And, you know, I promised myself and I promised my mother that I would get her story out here, and for the very reason of letting people know the reality and, you know, how hard it really is. And that's what I plan on doing. So, yeah, it feels good to be able to put her stuff into words, her story into words, because she shared a lot with me. She wrote a lot of things down, things I've saved, and my memory of all the things that she talked about from childhood on up. So, yeah, it's going to be a powerful story.
It really is. I'm going to go to Penelope. We're just going to take
okay.
a couple minutes. You've got 20 minutes left on the show, and we do still have about five panelists. So I'm going to go to Penelope, then we'll go to Carol, and
okay.
then we'll go to Kim.
Let's roll it along.
Then we'll go to Adrian. Okay. So go ahead, Penelope.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you, Pamela. I had a quick question and a comment. My question is, what was your brother's name who passed away, your brother that passed away when you were six?
My brother, his name was John Patrick Sega, and we used to call him John John. That was his nickname, but his name was John.
Thank you. You had mentioned John once before, and I just, okay, that was it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And then my other comment was of all the things you said, and I wish there was more time. But something was very poignant, and I think for those that are, you know, listening and are going to stream later, you said, you know, I buried my abuse, you know, I was very successful, you were an honor student, you know, you were, you know, went out into the world and looked like a healthy, adjusted woman, got married, had three children, and then all of a sudden it caught up with you.
Mm.
And I think, you know, one of the things of the healing journey for me was, same thing, you know, when you hit a wall, you don't have a choice. You know, I don't think anybody has ever been able to successfully bury complex trauma and come away unscathed. And just so maybe just if you could expand, just I know for a minute or two on, you know, at the point where there's the point of no return where you have to address it and go through the healing process. You can't just sidestep it.
Yeah. For me, it was the nightmares were coming deeper and darker. The flashbacks were coming deeper and darker. And I'm going to tell you, my breaking point was this. I was pregnant with a fourth child, and that child unfortunately passed away. I was like 15 weeks pregnant, and I had to go through a procedure to have it removed. That pivotal moment is what threw me back to the moment when I had an abortion after going through all that abuse. That put me on such a spiral, a downward spiral, and I was starting to have flashbacks during the day when I'm taking care of the children and my kids, and I'm like, oh my God, I can't figure out if I'm in the past or the present, and I'm hearing my kids talk to me, but I couldn't, I really couldn't focus on it because all I could see was the abuse happening to me. And this was happening to me more and more. It happened to me out in public. I had my kids out at a restaurant, and we were eating and in a lunch, and it was happening there, and I couldn't breathe. And I had to collect myself, collect my three small children, get them home safely. And that, for me, was the moment when I said, no more. I have to confront it. And that's what I did. And I knew it was time. But, yeah, we can't run from it forever. It's always there. You could bury it for so long. I buried it so deep. And then when it came out, it was a volcanic explosion, like, to say the least. Yeah. It was brutal. And the flashbacks and nightmares were devastating. And at the same time, I was still trying to raise my kids and do what I had to do.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Thank you for
You're welcome.
I can relate to it, and I think it's just so helpful for people to listen to your testimony and to hear that. And by the way, I just ordered your book.
Well, thank you.
I had ordered for my sister, and now I just ordered it for myself. So love you, Lisa, and thank you. Thank you so much.
I love you, too. Thank you. Thank you for supporting me always. I appreciate it.
Always.
Yeah, I've read the book. It's a page-turner, but people, so if you don't want to wait if you have work to do or something else, you better not get the book yet because you won't be able to put it down, I promise you.
Oh, God.
Okay, let's go to Carol. Oh, Carol, I can't wait to hear what you got to say. Hey, Carol.
Well, let me tell you something. We've got one tough little cookie here. Yes, we do. And, you know, and I like that. I like that. I like the fact that you don't let what happened define you for the rest of your life, because there is life after abuse, okay? Again, mental illness is something that needs to be addressed more. As I was growing up, I was so filled with that anger that you had, and I understand that, and I wanted to actually twist people's heads off.
I understand that.
Yeah. One day I just dropped to the ground because I was just too exhausted with hatred.
Yeah.
And I said, no more, no more. And I was thrown out. I didn't have any choices in the matter. I was thrown out, you know, several times and told that I wasn't loved and all this other stuff. And then I found out after the book, Lisa, that my bio father, I'm saying this on air, was not my father, and that's one reason why my mother hated me, because she was raped.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and I'm sorry to hear that, and I know we've talked about that before. And
That's
powerful in itself.
Yeah, and you know what? It makes me understand, but not accept, because, you see, we don't have to forgive, okay? We don't have to.
We don't.
And no. Especially when they're not sorry, okay?
Yeah. You know, I'm not laughing out of laughter, but it's just so true.
But you know what? You turned out wonderful. We're all very proud of you. We know
thank
your
you.
Work. We know the work that you do. And please keep it up. And thank you so much for being a guest on this show. You're not a guest. You're a family member, but you know what I'm saying.
I do.
Yes, and I love you. We all love you. Okay.
Yeah, and I love you. I love you too. And I always love connecting with you.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks, Carol. Kim?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
I'm here. Well, I just wanted to say, Lisa, you are so strong too. I just want to reiterate that. And
thank you.
You know, I think, like you said, there's always, I feel the same way. Like, there was just something that was guiding me as a child that just helped me get through that all. And, you know, helped us come out somewhat normal. I told my aunts the other day, we're like sisters, and I said, I think we're the normal one. But that's scary.
That's what we always say, define normal.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever that means, I think we are the normal ones.
Yes.
That generation of abuse, there is generational
yes.
abuse, and it wasn't by the same perpetrator, which I think is hard for people to understand a lot of times, you know, how that can continue throughout generations. But
yes,
my
I
mom
agree.
Basically said, it happens. It just happens that, you know, your daughter will get sexually abused. No.
No.
That's the way I thought. So, no, it's not going to happen. So, just know that I am, again, just here hugging you and keeping you in my prayers. And I look forward to connecting with you and getting to know you better.
Yes, thank you. You too. And like I said, connect. I always tell people reach out because I'm always available.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing your story.
Oh, thank you for listening. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you, Kim. All right, we're going to go to Adrian, our PA ambassador. Adrian, do you have a comment, question? Adrian?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, Lisa.
Hi.
I know how awesome you are now because I'm reading your page. I am
okay.
So how great of an ambassador you are, how you use your child abuse trauma recovery story to basically help others, and your single purpose here says to promote NASCA and
mm-hmm.
just help people with child abuse and their traumas, sexual assault, violence, and physical abuse. And here, as an ambassador, you say each of us can be a service to adult survivor community, and you're constantly using your story. And it says here just how you're just constantly inviting people to share and pass on through groups and stuff. And then just how you're all doing everything here. It says here you've just been totally inviting people to join NASCA in there through their Zoom, the programs and stuff. Out of
yes.
everything you're doing, and you're doing awesome things, what is your next step for your Massachusetts ambassadorship? I mean,
so, you know what I'll tell you exactly. I was going to share this earlier, but since you put it out there, I'm going to talk about it a little bit. Right now, what I've been working on and using my title for is I'm pushing for mental health programming in our school systems to help our youth, because just this year alone, what the kids have been through, the trauma and of being isolated and home alone and being home in abusive situations, and then they have to go back to school and try to learn. These kids are so damaged. And there should always have been mental health programming in our schools, because kids, as we talk about our own stories, we were these abused kids. We lived in silence. This next generation of kids are living through all these things, and they're not getting the proper support either. So I've been pushing for mental health programming. So tonight, just before the show, I was on a meeting for the Massachusetts Teachers Association, and I was able to speak about my thoughts and plans. And, of course, I proudly use my title. You know, when I loved when I'm able to say that, Lisa Zarcone, Massachusetts National Ambassador for NASCA, because I'm like, that is who I am, and that's a part of me, and very proud to use it. But I was able to speak to Senator Lesser here in Massachusetts directly about my thoughts about, you know, what the children are going through and how we need to help them as we step forward. So that is what I'm doing right now with my title, is pushing forward for mental health programming. Hopefully this is something that is going to start here in Massachusetts, and I'm hoping that we could eventually make this, you know, worldwide, because it's how it should be. There's a lot of great programs out there that could be implemented in the school systems, and it always comes down to funding. Well, the time is now, and the funding is needed. So I had a great conversation, and then in a couple weeks I will be sitting down with Senator Gomez, who is another senator here out in Massachusetts, and him and I are having a one-on-one, and that's going to be all about my thoughts and ideas about how to implement these programs. So proudly using my title across Massachusetts, right on through to Boston if I have to. I've already sent letters to Governor Baker, and I'm just going to keep pushing my way until I get what I want, and what I want is to help these kids.
Yes. Well, I look forward. You're an awesome NASCA ambassador, and I look forward to talking to you and learning more as much as I can. And thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you. Thank you for calling in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. So is that the segment and what you wanted to say for the NASCA NASCA ambassadorship you're doing right now?
So, so what I'm doing right now is, you know, right now everything is online for me because, you know, here we are. I can't do workshops. I can't, you know, get out there and push because of COVID. But I'm hopefully once this lifts and I could start to do workshops again and get out there and talk, you know, it's always, you know, not just about my story. My platform is about NASCA as well. And, you know, giving back to community and getting out there and talking to people, sharing my story. And you know, at some point, I'm hoping to do like a support group, so that could be down the line for me too. You know, a NASCA support group. You know, I think I've talked to you about that before. I've spoken to Bill about it, and you know, we can do like support groups in our own communities. You could do it at a library, community center, and just have, you know, adult survivors come and just kind of and just support one another. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, therapy. It's just about supporting.
Absolutely. So what would you tell other ambassadors? We're trying to get the ambassador program to come alive again. We're trying to revive it. Carol tried, and a lot of the ambassadors are in title only. They're not really doing anything. So
yeah, and I think, you know, me personally, I think that it's, you know, we take on these titles, and I always think it's with good intention to, you know, to help others. And I think it's hard for, I think, some people, even once you take on that role, to take the next step, because now you're really putting yourself out there. You really, you know, have to put yourself into community, and you have to stand in front of people and say, yeah, this is me. This is what happened. Now how can I help you? I think the best thing that ambassadors can do is do like some of the things that I do in regards to, you know, reaching out, doing, I do podcast interviews. I do, you know, just all types of things to connect with people. Even like my Facebook inspirational page, I connect every single day with people, and I use my title, but I just also use my skills, you know, supporting skills, inspirational skills, you know, caring, all those things, and people connect to that. But you know, just even to get out into your, you know, your own community and find out what the services are, you know, your DMH services or child services, and where can you implement yourself as an ambassador? As an ambassador, how can you implement yourself into any of these places, and how could you be of service? And I think for everybody it'll be a little different. I mean, because whatever, you know, state you live in or town you live in, you know, but you can put yourself out there. Community centers, even senior centers. You know, it's interesting because seniors are the ones that lived silence before we did, and they all have
Absolutely.
A story. They all have a story.
Wow.
One of the most profound moments for me will always be after one of my author talks and workshops, a woman came up to me, and she was like 80 years old, and she said to me, she held my hand, and she says, "You have given me the strength to tell my story." And I looked at her,
wow.
You know, and she says, "I've never told anybody about my abuse." Imagine carrying that for all those years. This woman held it for all those years. And she broke down in front of me and cried with her daughter standing next to her with her mouth wide open, because now all of a sudden she's just telling me things.
What?
And I just let her talk, and she cried, and I spoke to her, and we just had some words together, and her daughter thanked me, and I was just in awe that I can do that for somebody.
So your message that I'm hearing that we've been talking about is find another survivor to talk to, because if it's not another survivor, they'll never understand, and they'll reject you. I've had that happen before. I've gone to the wrong person, tried to be heard, and they couldn't wrap their mind around it. We've got 7 minutes left, and so I want you to take 3 minutes of that, or 4 minutes of that time, and I want you to talk straight to the audience streaming in, you know, and just talk about whatever you want to tell people that need hope.
Hope, that's another big word. All these words, you know, when you think hope, you think faith, inspiration, you know, they all touch us in different ways. But, you know, to say that other survivors, you know, here we are, we're all surviving. We've all survived abuse of some sort, whether it be sexual or mental or physical or all of the above. We're all survivors, and we're all still standing. We might all be standing at different stages of our healing journey, but we're standing, and we're standing together. And I think that's where hope and faith really comes into play, because look around and listen. Listen to the other stories, and as you hear people, you know, you hear my story tonight, we've heard everybody's stories, and you go, wow, we've all been through something, but we're still surviving. And then you think about taking it to the next level. Let's thrive. What's going to, you know, what's going to make our world better for ourselves, you know, and take that journey for you. It's not for everybody around you. It's for you. And keep going and keep working at it and find happiness in good places. And, you know, the more you heal and the more you work on yourself and you let those that darkness go, the more you find joy.
Uh-huh.
And joy could be the smallest things. Me, personally,
yeah.
I can go outside. If I see a butterfly, I'm like the goofy, excited woman jumping up and down going, oh, my God, it's a butterfly. You know, but... you know, or a bird, or, you know, but that's just me because I'm so connected to nature. But, like, the point I'm making is, like, find that niche for yourself. What's going to put the smile on your face? What are the little things that make you happy? Those are the things you got to tap into and connect to, because life is hard. Whether you've been abused or not abused, life can be hard. We've all been through something. And then when you add abuse and trauma and, you know, PTSD and all these things that we've been through, it's been really hard. And what's the best reward for living such a hard life? And that's joy.
Right.
So,
you know?
One more question. What has NASCA done for you? What has NASCA done for you?
NASCA's done so much for me. I remember connecting with Bill back when my story first came out, and I am so different from that person 5 years ago because I was so terrified to share and talk about it out loud. I put the book together, and now I'm like, oh crap, I got to really talk about it because it's in the book, and you know. And but back then I'm going, oh my God, now Bill wants me on the show, and what am I going to do? But then I came out and I told my story, and everybody was so kind to me, and I think that's the biggest thing that sticks out in my head when I think about the first time I talked on NASCA. I spoke with Bill Pryor, and Bill was just so kind to me, and it just made me feel so comfortable. It made me feel like, you know, I can do it. He did. He gave me confidence. And I got on, and I spoke, and everybody on the panel was just so phenomenal to me. And Carol was, oh, my God, just Carol always sticks out of my mind because she just really, she made such a huge impression on me. And I was like, wow, like I'm surrounded by so many loving, caring, powerful people. And I say powerful in a good way because we're just all together, we're thriving, we're sharing. So NASCA gave me that love. It gave me the confidence. NASCA gave me my title, which helps me do what I think I've always been meant to do, which is advocate and share and help. NASCA has given me so much, and I am always grateful. And you know, I feel bad that I can't get on the show at night like I wish I could all the time because my schedule is just so insane. But I am always grateful for NASCA and everything it's done for me, and this is always family.
Got 90 seconds, so I'm going to wrap up the show. I want to thank you so much, Lisa, for coming out back on and sharing all the insight and wisdom that you have and your story. Oh, it's just phenomenal. And how you're still standing,
thank you.
I can't, it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal that we're all still standing past the beach.
It is. We all have a journey. We all have a journey.
Show up now. Right, embrace the journey. That's what she says, because you never know what will fall into your path, and every moment is a valuable lesson. That's quoted by Lisa Zarkon. So good night, everybody. Thank you for being here. I want to thank our panel. I want to thank our guests. Thank my co-host, Penelope. And if you see something, say something, because we love our children. Good night, and God bless.
God bless.
Good night, Lisa. You are rock.
Blog Talk Radio.